Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something to help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, temperance, and wisdom. And then here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers. We explore at length how these Stoic ideas can be applied to our actual lives and the challenging issues of our time. Here on the weekend, when you have a little bit more space, when things have slowed down, be sure to take some time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with your journal, and most importantly, to prepare for what the week ahead may bring. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. It's always sensitive talking about these things, but Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor's visits. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance needed. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/TDS. That's hims.com/TDS for your personalized ED treatment options. Hard mints are a chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with your healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now. Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. In Lives of the Stoics, I tell a story about a guy named Rutilius Rufus. And Rutilius Rufus is really interesting because he's a guy at the top of the Roman political game, and he witnesses corruption in one of Rome's provinces. Basically, some other elites are looting this province, mistreating the people who live there. And he effectively reports it. He makes the corruption public. And you might like to think that he's received and celebrated and rewarded for doing the right thing. But the Stoics knew that that's not how life works. In fact, Rutilius Rufus is not only not thanked for what he did, but he's brought up on corruption charges by the people who are engaged in the corruption, found guilty by a kangaroo court, and exiled. He's sent away. He loses everything. He does the right thing, and he loses everything. Rutilius Rufus not only doesn't complain about this, he doesn't even utter a word in his own defense. And he basically does the right thing because it's the right thing and is actually received with open arms back to the province that he had helped protect. If you could have asked him why he did it, despite all the negative consequences, why he was fearless in doing the right thing, he would have said, because the right thing matters. And that's actually the title of my guest today's riveting memoir, one of the most important books and important figures in recent American political history, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman's new book, Here Right Matters, about being a whistleblower that led directly to the impeachment of the President of the United States. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman was most recently the Director of European Affairs on the White House's National Security Council. And prior to retiring from the U.S. Army, he served as a foreign area officer with assignments in the U.S. embassies in Kiev, Ukraine, and Moscow, and for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff as a political military affairs officer. He's a doctoral student and Foreign Policy Institute fellow at Johns Hopkins University. He's a military fellow at the Lawfare Institute. He served honorably in Iraq, almost two decades of service in the U.S. Army. And he finds himself staring down the most powerful man in the world, the allies of the most powerful man in the world, enormous media attention. And despite being completely in the right and bringing forth alarming behavior and corruption at the highest levels, he loses his job at the White House. His brother loses his job at the White House. And indeed, his military career comes to an end because of it. And yet, why did he do it? Because, as he tells his father, here, right matters. Right, doing the right thing matters in America. It matters as a military officer. It matters as a human being, and it matters as a Stoic. So I was so excited and honored to be able to talk to Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. We have a fascinating talk about philosophy, about ethics, about standing up for what you believe in, and most of all, courage. So I encourage you to read his book, Here Right Matters. Our conversation also dovetails perfectly with my new book, Courage is Calling, Fortune Favors the Brave. It's up for pre-order right now at dailystoic.com/pre-order. You can get a whole bunch of awesome bonuses from me, including actual pages from the manuscript that I wrote, signed by me. It comes out September 28th, available everywhere books are sold. But if you go to dailystoic.com/pre-order, you get a bunch of bonuses. I'm really excited about this book. And my conversation with Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, to me, is exactly what I'm talking about in the book. He's the kind of figure that I would have liked to have put in the book. And as we open our conversation, a wonderful example of where physical courage and moral courage come together in a really important way. And so I'm excited about his book, Here Right Matters, which I read and very much enjoyed, and my new book, Courage is Calling, Fortune Favors the Brave. Check them both out, and please be brave. Do the right thing. Stand up for what you believe in. If you see something, say something, speak up. As Marcus Aurelius says, just that you do the right thing. The rest doesn't matter. You know, the book I'm working on right now, actually, it comes out in a month. I'm doing a book on courage, and it being the first of the four Stoic virtues. And one of the things I thought a lot about in the book, and you seem to be the perfect person to talk to about it because you've experienced it from both sides. We make this distinction between moral courage and physical courage. And you have had to experience both in Iraq and then facing down the most powerful person in the world, the eyes of the world upon you, risking your job, your livelihood, et cetera. Talk to me about that distinction. And I'd also be curious, like, what's actually scarier?
Yeah. No, first of all, thank you for having me on. I'm glad I could have this conversation with you, Ryan. But I'll tell you, I've talked about this same theme repeatedly, actually. At one point, I was asked to do a TED talk, and I didn't do. I ended up not doing it because I was still in uniform, and I, you know, didn't want to kind of further rock the boat and all that kind of stuff. But it was after I was drawn into prominence, and the themes I started thinking about were exactly, you know, the central theme of moral versus physical courage, and how physical courage is easily identified. Often prized with medals, people get award medals, you know, firemen running into a burning building, policemen, you know, conducting a heroic action. On the battlefield, it's easy, you know, people get awarded medals for that kind of stuff. But moral courage is much harder to identify. It's also too often undervalued. But I think, in my view, it's moral courage that tends to really drive change and be most impactful. And I guess I was thinking about, like, you know, folks that displayed moral courage that changed the course of history. Mahatma Gandhi with, nonviolent protest. Rosa Parks with civil disobedience. Same thing with Martin Luther King. There are, you know, these are folks that I'm not by any means comparing myself to.
Of course.
But they're the most kind of elevated forms of moral courage that are extolled, but more common forms of moral courage are not, and they're kind of overlooked. And sometimes I'd say they come with a much higher cost, right?
Sure.
You know, there might be a personal danger associated with physical courage, but it's like, you know, you survive it, you're good. There's not as often an enduring price to be paid.
Well, that was one of the things I was thinking about. Is it's interesting that you bring up Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and Rosa Parks, because as much as that's moral courage, there's also a profound physical element to what they did, both sort of putting their body in danger. So when I was thinking about it, I sort of came to this definition that it's actually, there's only one form of courage, and that's when you put your ass on the line. Sometimes that's literally, sometimes that's figuratively, but it seems like in both cases, whether you're in Iraq or you're testifying in front of Congress, you're having to put your ass on the line, either reputationally the future of your career, or you're going out not knowing if you're going to survive and come home.
In your book, how do you draw? Then how do you identify? We'll turn this back on interview for you, but how do you, I guess, differentiate between, you know, what's prized in physical courage versus what's not so kind of recognized in moral courage?
Well, again, we don't have to make this about your book, about my book, because I loved your book and we're going to talk all about it. I guess I'm just saying that the distinction may be arbitrary and without, it's a distinction without a difference, right? Like at the end of the day, both, society needs both, they both matter. And what I think is really interesting is how often we see people who are capable of physical courage and not capable of moral courage, and people who are capable of moral courage but not capable of physical courage, when probably ideally they should be fused together.
I think that's right. And I think it's the only difference might be in the fact that how society kind of prizes and reflects them. The answer to your question is, which one was more difficult? I would say that the Ukraine scandal and the testimony was a lot more difficult, because in terms of Iraq, you know, you get trained to respond to certain things in certain ways, including in combat. And I quickly kind of fell back on my training. I allude to this in the story in the book. And I fell back on my training. You know, there
keep
was
moving,
no,
don't get bogged down.
Yeah. Don't, you know, there's no, like, you know, there was no kind of overwhelming fear in that moment there, you know, not to discount the fact that, you know, there's like legitimate rational fear in combat, but that wasn't the case, then. And I think it's probably not the case for most soldiers in contact. They're doing what they need to do. But this was a much more mindful kind of activity. You know, even if the first report was, you know, with minimal danger in mind, maybe some, you know, kind of extra scrutiny at the White House or losing my position at the White House, I didn't think I was going to lose my military career. By the time I was testifying in front of Congress, I knew, you know, what I was getting into. But I also wasn't going to be cowed. I wasn't going to be weak-kneed. I wasn't going to kind of, you know, lose composure. I was not going to... I wasn't going to be bullied into, you know, taking less than what I thought was a proper principled stand.
Well, yeah, maybe that's an interesting distinction too, is that physical courage is often very brief, punctuated with violence or danger. But the Ukraine scandal, you know, we're only a year out from it now. It's still ongoing for you. There's still ramifications and consequences. And you're still, I mean, you, it's like you leaped, but you're not even quite sure where you're going to land yet, right? You're still falling.
That's exactly right, in terms of both consequences. And, you know, because people now, you know, believe I'm politicized or I'm a hot potato, and most people are kind and, you know, open to talking to me, but there are people that are apprehensive and don't want to be denounced by Trumpers. There's a lot of ambiguity with regards to, next steps, even though I'm engaged in some really pretty awesome work, working on a doctorate, working in a think tank, you know, having this book come out. But there's long-term kind of uncertainty. And in a lot of ways, I had a softer landing because of how prominent my position was, that most whistleblowers that show, you know, moral courage don't get. And yes, have to deal with these challenges in, you know, much, much more significant way.
Right. Yeah. You didn't have a 20-year court battle to finally get your chance in front of the cameras. You weren't being followed by private investigators for years, et cetera. In some cases, yours was the whole thing compressed down into a year that some of these whistleblowers you read about, you know, endured for decades.
Right. Right.
So yeah, I think let's go back to the idea of why if a person is capable of one, do they seem to struggle with the latter? And I think it's particularly interesting in the military domain, where you see people who fought in wars, who fought in battle.
I just got this one, Alpha, about Eddie Gallagher, and somebody that was physically courageous,
yes,
but obviously lacked, you know, moral courage. And yes, there's too many of these types of things.
Yes. And so why is it, I guess I'm so interested. You're somebody who can face down bullets, is not even afraid to stare down the president in an impeachment proceeding as you are, but it just doesn't want to be like lightly out of favor, right? Like, it's interesting how soft the landing would be for most of these people and how petrified they are of even the slightest deviation from being on the inside of things.
That's exactly right. And the only thing I could think of is, again, you know, you could train somebody, you could kind of build a muscle memory to react to kind of combat. You could train somebody to be a physical specimen and kind of, you know, run through fire and stuff like that. But it's a much, much harder thing to train moral courage, to instill values and ethics. And we don't exercise that in the same way. You could actually, I have this, you know, this line of reasoning that I've kind of laid out, especially when I talk to younger folks, about exercising moral courage like a muscle and building muscle memory. You could do that. You could do, you know, if you're an infantryman, you train on reflexive fires, you know, stress shoots and all that kind of stuff. You could train how to do that. It's much, much more difficult to train leaders to display moral courage and, you know, adhere to ethics and values when the stakes are kind of, in a lot of ways, higher, not to life, limb, or eyesight, but to kind of prospects, career prospects, and successes, imaginings of where, you know, you might end up. And my simple answer to this is, you public service often engenders a duty to something other than yourself.
Yes.
And you could build your kind of your ethics and values muscles through service externally oriented, and train yourself to kind of respond in the way you would like to respond in smaller challenges and in progressively tougher challenges. And then when you're faced with really kind of pivotal moments, critical junctures, you're actually, you know, you have all the tools in play, then you just need to trust yourself that you've built all that muscle memory, moral muscle memory, to respond accordingly.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Like, someone will be willing to run into battle and potentially lose their life, but then they're like, I don't want to say something, I might lose my job. And you're sort of like comparing the stakes. And yet, for some reason, we're much more afraid of the latter than the former, even though it's fundamentally, objectively irrational.
Forethought. I think the difference is forethought. The yes. Moral courage recovers forethought, whereas I think physical courage does not.
It's in the moment.
It's in the moment, and it's self-preservation. It kind of feeds to the most basic instinct of survival, whereas the other one requires kind of higher reasoning and forethought.
So that forethought is really important then, because you talk about this at the beginning of the book when you're talking about some of your critiques of American policy vis-a-vis the Russians. And then you talk about at the end, you sort of your wrap-up lessons, you talk about this idea of self-deterrence, which is basically, we know what we should do, we know what a good response would be, but then we talk ourselves out of it. And so it sounds like what you're saying is, forethought is often us convincing ourselves that we have a good reason to not do what we know we should do.
Or a forethought could be the fact that we recognize, you know, we have some perspective. In my case, I had the perspective that this is, you know, a historical moment. I had the forethought that this was kind of our democracy in the balance in certain ways, with the president trying to undermine free and fair elections. I had the forethought, you know, of geopolitics and what this might mean for kind of U.S. national security, with undermining Ukraine security. I had all this. And in that case, my forethought drove me singularly to the idea of, you know, upholding my duty, as opposed to talking myself out of it. But the lesson on self-deterrence is, you know, it's more complex than just kind of your own actions and your own biases. It's the fact that adversaries, in often cases, understand those biases and feed those biases. In the case of Russia, they breed self-deterrence. They have a whole doctrine around it, reflexive control. They do something that kind of, you know, provokes a kind of like a, you know, almost irrational response, because they're doing saber rattling and threatening nuclear war, when in reality, they have no greater, you know, interest in a war where they're going to be annihilated also. So it's being mindful of your own kind of circumstances, but also the environment around you. Like, self-deterrence could have been bred by the fact that it's a notoriously vindictive administration, and that, you know, I should, they're trying to convince people to not testify because they're going to get retaliated against. So it's all of that. And it's pretty awesome that we're having this conversation. It's hard to believe that we're still breaking new ground. Like, this is the last thing I've got on my plate for like 2 weeks or a week and change. So that's good.
Well, I want to nerd out with you about it. So in my book, Stillness is the Key, one of the people I was fascinated with is Kennedy. And I talk about the Cuban Missile Crisis, and you as a Russian expert might be able to tell me if I got it wrong or not. But to me, that was such a profound blending of physical and moral courage, in that he was both deterred and not deterred, right? He was able to think through what the enemy wanted him to think. He was able to think about it on moral levels. He was aware of what their response is and what his response should be. And he's sort of able to think it out and be strategic. So he proceeds, but he doesn't proceed in the way that we often mistake courage, which is sort of a fit of passion or bravery or an aggressive clapback. He sort of goes, okay, here's what the enemy did. Here's what the enemy thinks I'm going to do. Here's what people want me to do. And sort of playing that multidimensional chess into a measured but firm response is a good example of physical and moral courage together.
I think that's right. And there are, frankly, have been very few examples of people effectively managing the Russia relationship because they don't understand the Russians and they don't go through those kind of layered calculations of, addressing kind of the urgencies that are being driven by U.S. constituencies, including the defense establishment. Pressure is being applied by the Russians directly, the threat of a full-scale war, and taking it really up to the brink and managing to navigate. That was obviously a phenomenal navigation of a very perilous event. I think in a lot of ways, I don't know if Reagan was quite as sophisticated, but he was as successful, I'd say, in a lot of ways. And the first George Bush, maybe in certain regards also, but that's really, there are not that many examples. I mean, maybe Nixon with regards to China and detente, but we're not very good at it in general, I think.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next to listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, well, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500.
There's a great quote from Marcus Aurelius, he's writing it in his journal, but he says, not what the enemy hopes you will see, but what's really there. And yeah. I think when we're responding to stuff, you have to see through both the real dangers and the fake dangers and then sort of land on what you think is right.
Yep.
Well, jumping ahead, though, and I want to come back to some stuff, but because you brought it up, I think when people think about whistleblowers or they think about, you know, moral courage, even I guess sometimes physical courage, they often just think like, is this right or wrong? And obviously the title of the book is Here Right Matters. But I thought it was really interesting towards the end of the book. Yes, right matters. But you also talk about a need to be strategic about it and intelligent about it and think through your options. Just because you were on the side of right doesn't mean you're going to be successful. And it doesn't mean that the world is going to receive you with open arms. I think sometimes I particularly think about this with my generation. We just think that, you know, might makes right. And that's not, or right makes might. And that's not really true.
You know, what's interesting about it is, you know, sometimes people would think that I'm kind of naive in that statement of here, right matters. But I think if you read the book, I hope that it comes across that I'm pretty damn thoughtful at, you know, every single turn. And I didn't, you know, fully uncover every kind of nuance of the way I thought through things. But I was very thoughtful about understanding that this was that was a vindictive administration, about selecting counsel that would not necessarily kind of Republican counsel that would not, you know, telegraph or overly alarm White House counsel because they had direct rapport with them, you know, some interactions with the White House that was being belligerent and sending out talking points and saber-rattling as much as I could as a uniformed officer on my own. I was very, you know, calculating about how to do these things, but always falling back on the, you know, the kind of the basic principle of what is the right thing to do, how to do that right thing in the right way. So always focused on the right, or doing the right thing, but kind of the right way also being a critical component of that equation. And, you know, because there were any number of times where I could have really kind of stepped in it. You know, if this report was done not through proper channels, but through, you know, a report to the media and I leaked something, that whole, it would have undermined the whole legitimacy of the report and my credibility. You know, if I had kind of, you know, if I decided to take a more public position outside of where I had to, which was in public testimony, you know, if I had extra commentary in addition to that, that would have been, that probably could have destabilized the situation. Anywhere along the way, I could have tripped up. And it's frankly almost a miracle that things kind of unfolded the way they did. And the way I rationalize it is I strung together enough right things in the right way, simple kind of decisions, frankly, you know, transactional, and strung enough of those together to navigate something that was, you know, unforeseeable and extremely complex.
Yeah, there's a great quote about De Gaulle, and I don't have it exactly, but he's saying like people see the courageous stand, and he's like, you don't understand how manipulative I had to be behind the scenes, how many conversations I had to have, how many people I had to recruit. You don't understand just the sheer sort of maneuvering required to do what to the public just seems like you say what you think and you give a public testimony, and that's the end of it. That was. Yeah. I don't want to say stage managed, but you maneuvered yourself into a position to have the impact that you had.
That's true. The single point where I'd say the complexity doesn't really exist is in my, you know, in the seminal moment, my complaint. Yes. That one was like the only forethought was that I recognized the gravity of the moment. You know, I say that when I make that point very clear when I walk into my twin brother's office and say, if the president, you know, if the president's actions are disclosed, he's going to be impeached. And, you know, the time it took me to walk from the Situation Room up to my third floor offices in a legal shop, that's it. There was no, like, you know, a deliberation on what I knew I had to do. It's everything afterwards, you know, trying to see if I preserve preserve the possibility of a career, reputation, and all those other things that ended up becoming far, far more complex and really required in certain ways, maybe more kind of clarity and courage than that initial behind the scenes report.
I loved your brother's role in it. I was particularly impressed with your wife. She seems like one heck of a lady.
Yeah, she's pretty awesome. She's the troll slayer. You know, I think you mentioned that you know Arnold Schwarzenegger. When we were over at his house, I mentioned that I refer to my wife as a troll slayer. So he brought out his Conan the Barbarian sword, and he basically, you know, he showed her how to kind of wield it to trace the troll, slay some trolls. So
I read a good book called Crisis of Conscience, and I had the guy on the podcast last year. But do you know who Ernie Fitzgerald is? He was a guy in the Pentagon who was a whistleblower about waste inside the Pentagon in the 80s, in the 70s and 80s. But he was asked in one of his after this testimony that cost him a promotion, stuff you're all familiar with. And they said, you know, so why did you do this? And he said, or they asked his wife too. And she said, I told him that I really didn't think I could live with a man I didn't respect. And if he went out there and lied, I'd have no respect for him. And it struck me that your wife was probably a bit of a backbone for you in all of this, in moments that you might have doubted yourself or wondered if it was all worth it.
I think that's true. Ultimately, I knew my wife, you know, my dad, my twin brother, I knew they all had my back. I would say at times, you know, without parsing who said what, there was, you know, discussion about, like, you know, more moderated approaches to kind of testimony, you know, doing what, frankly, what would have made the Army and the Department of Defense more comfortable, which is yes, no answers and kind of lies of omission and stuff like that. That's what would have made my senior military kind of leadership, you know, more comfortable and would have, in their mind, kept me apolitical, strangely enough. And I, you know, ultimately I, you know, determined I was going to take my own counsel on this. I'd have to live with my own, actions. You know, I allude to the fact that I would have to kind of, look my daughter in the eye and justify my actions, when she gets older. And I did what I thought was right.
But let me ask you about that, because I think that's something that holds people back. So obviously, for instance, the 300 Spartans, they go to fight at Thermopylae. A lot of people don't know they were chosen precisely because they all had children, right? Mm-hmm. Each one was the father of at least one living son. The idea being they wouldn't let their children down by being cowards in battle. But you could also see the same argument that that's who you wouldn't pick because they would want to get home to their children, right? So that I think a lot of people, you know, they go like, I know what the right thing is. I know what a courageous person should do in this situation. But they go, it's not fair to my spouse, to my kids, to the collateral damage of this decision. And so they're not saying, well, they're saying like, I would do it if it was just up to me, but I don't want to do it because I'm too selfless, right? Or something. We talk ourselves out of it for what feels like a good reason, but where does that leave us? So walk me through how you think about collateral damage to a decision.
Yeah, the Cara Leonig's book, I Alone, where is it? No, what is it now? Sorry, I should know this title. Let's see. I Can Fix It.
Sorry. I Alone Can Fix It.
I Alone Can Fix It. I just clicked off of something here. But, you know, that's exactly it. You know, that there's a psychology around folks that think that they're the guardrails or that they need to maintain position in order to kind of avert even a bigger catastrophe. And it's, I think it's probably more, you know, ego and hubris than is appropriately justified, especially in the military hierarchy where we habitually train, you know, fallout drills. You know, if the commander goes down, the XO steps up and stuff like that. And there's always somebody as competent or we failed in our mission to step up and do the same thing. So I think I think that's just the rationalization mechanism to allow people to not follow through and do the right thing in the right way rather than really substantive.
Yeah, I guess. But I mean, you didn't have to walk through like, hey, this is the right thing to do, but now I can't afford to send my daughter to college, right? Like, did you have to think about how the consequences of your stand are all, the burden of that is also borne by people that you love?
I did. And I think for, you know, maybe for even too long, I thought that my career, military career was going to be able to continue. But I also when I realized it wasn't, and it was in the middle of the pandemic and, you know, people were looking to for security, I didn't stick around for the purposes of just collecting a paycheck, you know, and hope that I was going to get promoted. I had the confidence that I was going to land on my feet. And part of that is the product of, you know, my family history that I talk about in the book. You know, the fact that my family, my father kind of restarted his life on multiple occasions, most recently at the age of 47, coming to the United States and hauling furniture, passing the civil service exam, becoming an engineer. I think that's, that's another thing about self-deterrence. You know, there's all these things, I describe is all of the tools I assembled in my life up until that point came into play. You know, this idea of self, and that's the way the book is written. It's a series of lessons that came together for me to manage the affair. It's starting over, keep starting over. It's, you know, don't self-deter. It's trust your equipment. You know, the fact that you've accumulated all your tools. It's everything coming together in that right moment.
I think your father's story is fascinating, and it's so strange where we've gotten as a society that we've, like, to me, one of the ultimate acts of moral courage is to immigrate. Like, they're not sending their best people. Immigrants are the best people. They're the people who had the courage to start over, to face danger and risk, to provide a better life. One of the people I've been reading about for the book is Frank Serpico, the whistleblower in the NYPD. When you read about his mother's journey to America, she gives birth on the boat across the Atlantic, lands at a charity hospital. She loses the baby. The people who were supposed to meet her don't show up. And she basically makes do as like a nanny for this family for like 2 years before her husband comes, not speaking a word of English. I then try to think about what would give someone the courage to challenge the entirety of the NYPD. It's the example of his mother.
Sure.
And was that for you with your father?
That's right. I think that's right. I think there were some very foundational lessons I learned from my father. First, he's a tough guy. In a lot of ways, suffered and had more kind of challenging experiences than I did. Through World War II, through losing his own father who died in combat, through having to work hard and start over, instilling some values, foundational values about kind of being truthful. I learned a lot of stuff from my father.
Another Serpico thing I thought you might have some thoughts on. He talks about how publicly he was persona non grata, but privately, all sorts of people were like, especially in the department, like, great job, we support you, we're not corrupt either, thank you for doing this. And he would always say to them, well, why aren't you standing with me publicly? And the reply was inevitably, and what, be an outcast like you? And I've got to imagine that you heard many messages of private support from people who you could have very much needed in your corner that weren't there. What is that phenomenon?
So that's very interesting. I'm looking forward to reading this book. I would say that I received a great deal of support from peers, colonels and below, but I heard absolutely crickets from senior leaders up the chain, even folks that I had been close to. You know, there was one individual I referenced in the book that was kind of managing me to kind of make sure I didn't go off the reservation or something like that. But that's really about it. The voices that would have indicated that I was still in good standing never kind of chimed in, frankly. And it's a little bit different than Serpico standards. Or a Serpico scenario where he actually had folks kind of coming out and telling him, and he could challenge him on that. I don't know if I even had quite that kind of level of support.
The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80.
Because I think part of it at the general officer level, they're kind of bureaucratic politicians, and they saw risk potentially in you know, offering that kind of support.
Isn't that a big part of it? Why, you know, we go like, why isn't the president or the CEO or the senator, why aren't they more outspoken about this, taking this risk? It seems to me that so much of that is because to get where they got, they had to be really good at not stepping in it along the way. So I think about Admiral Captain, I'm forgetting, the guy who's in charge of the Theodore Roosevelt during the pandemic. The COVID outbreak on his ship. Like, if he had not said anything, he'd still be in the Navy and probably have been promoted. So there, yes. So what's almost more impressive about what he did is you don't get in charge of a battleship if you're the guy who's always spouting off, never thinking of political consideration. So it's a balance, right? When you're political and when you go to the mattresses on something, I think that's a difficult balance for people.
That is very, very astute. I would say that one of the issues that we have with the officer corps right now is that they're competent officers, but they never risk too much. You know, that would really truly kind of like, and you could see it play out in like combat. They've never really truly risked too much that would have potentially upended their career. And they've never really misstepped. So it's kind of damning to say they're better than mediocre, but they're not the best.
Yes.
Because the people that have maybe risked more, may have even made some mistakes, were cast aside, and the force breeds these types of officers. And you see it come to bear in my situation. You see it come to bear in Captain Crozier's situation. You see it come to bear, frankly, in the consequences in Afghanistan, where, you know, people were not forthright in providing the best military advice to the political leadership, failed to really accomplish the mission, but cast their service in a way that allowed them to continue to advance.
Yeah. Do you know what the Peter Principle is?
I'm sorry, you broke up.
Oh, sorry. Do you know, like, it's, to me, that's an illustration of the Peter Principle.
Okay.
Do you know what that is?
Remind me.
The Peter Principle is that you get promoted to your level of incompetence, because then you stop getting promoted, But the problem is the people who are hyper competent usually end up leaving or going on to do other things. And your ranks, whether it's at a company or the military or politics, get filled with the people who are at their just level where they can't get any better or handle anything more difficult than what's on their plate.
I think Sun Tzu would have there's a highly appropriate Sun Tzu quote here to what we experienced in Afghanistan. Strategy without tactics is a slow road to victory. Tactics without strategy is a sure road to defeat. And I mean, basically, that's what we had. We really didn't have a particularly effective strategy that was being run by the senior leadership. And I think that, you know, kind of plays out in the bureaucracy at large.
And then you might argue the moral courage is nobody is speaking about that and escalating it up to a place where someone could do something about it.
I think that's right. The what may have been demanded at some point in the past is an officer corps that was willing to sacrifice their career. I mean, they're political appointees at the 3 and 4 star level, and sacrifice their career based on their conviction. Like, I had a conviction about what I thought was right, and I stayed with it. But they had a conviction that they kind of sacrificed, that, you know, maybe the theater wasn't going the right way. Additional resources were required, and they sacrificed their conviction for careerism.
So what is it where, like, I can almost understand, like, let's say I'm listening to the call or whatever, and I can maybe understand not doing something about it. People try to go, it's not my problem, it's not my fault. People don't. They don't have the courage to be in the hot seat that you step in. What's always fascinating to me in these situations is the people who then decide to attack the person who was in the hot seat. I think Biden's comments on some of the governors here in, like, where I live, where it's like, look, if you don't want to fight the pandemic, fine, but at least get out of the way, right? And so when I watch your testimony, what I'm struck by is the person who decided to wake up that day and be like, I'm going to try to fuck with this guy who is doing the right thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, that's really, I mean, that is in certain cases, they're partisan actors that know where their bread is buttered and basically know what they need to deliver in order to keep their, you know, keep themselves in favor. So I think that accounts for a large swath of these folks, but I also didn't really deliberate about who was going to report what. It was squarely on in my portfolio. I was the responsible officer. I was I had requested, coordinated, staffed, and done everything for that portfolio. So I really didn't pay that much mind. I mean, I looked up to see if anybody else took note, but I wasn't going to wait for somebody else to kind of report it or build a consensus. As a matter of fact, even when Fiona Hill was in position 2 weeks before, I refer to this meeting on July 10th, where Gordon Sondland, you know, first proposes the quid pro quo, saying that, you know, the instructions, he did this based on a conversation with Mick Mulvaney, right? I didn't wait for Fiona to report it. As soon as I told Gordon Sondland, no, I wasn't going to do it. This is kind of, you know, this is inappropriate. I went and reported it. It turns out that was exactly what Ambassador Bolton and Fiona Hill wanted to have happen. But, you know, I knew what my responsibilities were, and I was going, I think at some point, you know, especially at 20 years, you know what the right thing to do is. You don't need somebody to tell you what the right thing is. You should just do it.
That struck me as a flashback to your experience in Iraq, where you said you come under fire, there's the IED, you just felt a sense of calm in that moment. And you kind of, as gruesome and violent and bad as it was, you knew what you needed to do. It struck me as when this call happened, you knew what you needed to do.
I think that's right. I mean, it's interesting how, like, somebody could dissect, you know, the book and see, you know, what lessons kind of the way I constructed it, really, but what lessons, how those lessons kind of played in to the various decisions I made, in those fateful months in 2019.
Yeah. It's Mark Srealis has another good line. He says, just that you do the right thing, the rest doesn't matter. He says, tired or well-rested, despised or honored, warm or cold, just that you do the right thing. And do you think if you had known the consequences, it might have, I don't want to say changed your mind, but was part of it that you didn't think about what might happen? Do you know what I mean? Like, you obviously you knew he might be impeached because you said that, but did you think about, hey, I'm going to lose my job. My brother's going to lose his job at the White House. I'm going to be widely hated by this group of people. I'm going to have to find a new line of work. If you had thought about all of that, would it have caused you to lose heart, do you think, or it would have affected your calculation?
No. I mean, it sounds kind of facetious, but I'll tell you, there are certain things that you could imagine all the conversations that were going on behind the scenes. My attorneys telling me, look, just, offer minimal kind of, if you want, a military career, kind of like give give the kind of most, don't offer too much. My dad also, telling me that I need to come to an accommodation with the president, understand, counseling me that, you don't go up against power without consequence. So, I mean, it's not like I was blind to the events. I was hopeful, certainly, about the fact that, the military would act in accordance with values. But I also wasn't going to be deterred based on kind of some self-serving calculations. The hardest thing of all of these things, looking back and thinking about, my behavior is, I puzzled over what I would have done if the president was successful in his enterprise, which he, in certain ways, was very close to getting his investigation. It's not really widely known, but a couple of days before, the House committees launched their investigation into the hold on security assistance on September 11th. I think only a couple of days after that, Zelensky was scheduled to have a press conference with CNN to report the investigation. And it's because things unfolded the way they did, the president was unsuccessful in his enterprise. And I asked, I kind of asked myself, what would I have done if using the proper channels wasn't effective? If making the reports, if all this stuff, if the president could continue to obstruct lawful aid to directed by Congress. And I, based on my follow through, I guess, in testimony, I have a belief that I would do the right thing, but it's one of those kind of unknowns because it didn't unfold that way.
Yeah, like when I think about moments in my own life where I took risks, like when I dropped out of college, and I think other things where I saw things or I was a part of things and I maybe should have spoken up or should have spoken up earlier, my regrets, both when I was successful and when I fell short, was that I didn't have more confidence in myself. Right. And I think what I saw as the theme in your decisions is you believed not just that right matters, but you believed that you would be okay, whatever happened, right? You sort of, I'm going to do the right thing, come what may. And I think that when a lot of people are afraid, they don't want to speak up, they go like, well, I don't want to lose my job. What's interesting is, and I wonder what they could accomplish if they sat down and thought, you'll just get another fucking job, right? Like you're not going to end up, you almost certainly will not end up under a bridge somewhere, right?
That's right.
And so it seems like your confidence was a really integral part of you being able to get through this.
I think that's right. And I think that, again, that's a reflection of my family's experience starting over. I had all the things that my dad didn't necessarily have. I had advanced degrees. I had a decades long military career. I had a network of friends and supporters, that I could fall back on, even if I had to start over. I guess I had that confidence.
Yeah. And probably seeing your dad survive on so much less made you aware that you did have you did have quite a bit of privileges and advantages that you could fall back on here that even if you didn't have, you would be fine.
Yep, I think that's right. I think there's some perspective that, you could just look at the worst case scenario. You could look at kind of the costs and that might deter action. But I guess I always try to take a step back and look and have some perspective on things. And that always kind of helps.
You talk about Joshua Chamberlain at the end of the book. It's not that you're likening yourself to him, but it did strike me as you were making a statement that I think people are afraid to make or believe in, which is this idea of the great man of history theory, that like an individual can make a difference, right? That feels like not cool and maybe a bit naive. And I wonder if people are, they're afraid to do that.
This is a critical point. I think sometimes we're complacent because we either think things are going to work out, or we're complacent because we think that we can't have an effect on events. And I frankly, this is something that I want Americans to know, is that they actually have a voice and they can have an impact. Every person that chooses to want to have an impact can do that. And I just, you know, this is something that I believe in, because, you know, individuals that would otherwise be unremarkable have had kind of distinct impacts on history.
Well, the converse of that is also true. If you don't believe that an individual can make a difference, it's true in your case. You will not be the individual that makes a difference.
Very true.
And I think we want to think about, and I think this is, it's like, if you don't do something, who are you ceding the fields to?
There's a rabbi, Rabbi Hillel, very prominent rabbi, and he has this, there's a line, if not you, then who? If not now, then when? And I remember, you know, my rabbi kind of mentioning it to me, and there were a couple of like mantras that were going around in my brain. It was do the right thing in the right way. Don't self-deter. Don't be afraid to start over. These are the things that kind of like every now and then, army values, loyalty, duty, respect, selfless service, honor, integrity, personal courage. These are the things that like, you know, I would kind of, I don't know if they were explicit in every case, but these were the thoughts that kind of would rattle around when I had to make a weighty decision. And it didn't have to be something that kind of like I labored over ad nauseum, but something that I could, you know, weigh pretty quickly through those filters and make a decision on.
Yeah, Congressman John Lewis had that quote in his office as well. And you want to talk about an individual of moral courage who makes a difference. I mean, he was a kid and he changed the course of American history by stepping up and getting on a bus and being beaten.
Yeah.
So you thought about like, if not me, then who? That's one thing I'm not totally clear on. So somebody else also reported the call, right?
Well, so, you know, it's something that it's something I thought of afterwards, after I talked about this with my rabbi, and he kind of offered some counsel to kind of like, you know, to provide some support for me. But I made the point early on that I didn't really have to deliberate on the, you know, the first series of decisions at all. I just knew instinctively what to do. But afterwards, thinking about it, it made perfect sense. In terms of other people reporting it, well, so it turns out that Tim Morrison also reported it, but he couched it in a completely different way. He reported it because he was afraid there was going to be a leak, and he just wanted to alert the proper legal officials, which is, you know, frankly, a bunch of bullshit. Because
so he was just covering his ass, basically.
He was an attorney, and he's good at covering his ass, and he covered his ass in this case. In addition to that, you know, what's funny is that actually before we even had this phone call, I was like, hey, Tim, why don't we bring the attorneys into this? This might be a lively call. You know, you're familiar with the background, this incident that occurred with Ambassador Bolton 2 weeks before. And he kind of gives me a quizzical look, like he's kind of an asshole. He gives me a quizzical look, is like, why? And then he does this bullshit line on the back end to cover his ass, saying he just reported it because he didn't want any, you know, leaks or something like that. It's, you know, it's kind of the way he is.
So that was the other person who also reported. So you were the only one then?
Well, I guess I'm the only, I'm aware of the fact that I reported, Tim mentioned that he reported it in his testimony. I don't know who else reported it.
Interesting. Yeah, it's just funny how something could happen and multiple people see it, but everyone's sort of hoping it's the inverse of Hillel's line. If somebody else does it, then I don't have to do it.
Brian, I'm not sure what you're getting at. What are you trying to say?
No. I'm saying in all situations, this is what we do. We hope. Think about Kitty Genovese, right?
No, you're right. I'm joking about whether, like, you know, you're leading me down the road of like, are you, so what? You're their guy or something?
No. I'm just thinking about, like, I am fascinated with that Kitty Genovese incident. Hundreds of people hear it, and everyone thinks, well, I hope someone else will do it so I don't have to.
Terrible. Yep.
And so, I mean, some people, if they're trying to impugn you, are trying to say, oh, it's ego. You know, it's him wanting to. So is there ego in being like, I'm the individual to make a difference. I'm the one that needs to do it. Like, how does one balance between like, this is the right thing, and I'm just making this about me?
So there was probably some ego in, you know, my strong desire to want to serve on the NSC. It's a prestigious position. There is no ego in wanting to put yourself out in the middle of fire, you know, challenge the president of the United States, become a public figure. That's just not the world kind of that I come from. There's no real interest in there. But I guess, you know, I think your question is actually a little different. Is there a desire or an urgency to kind of say, you know, take it on my shoulders, that if it wasn't for me, this would never have happened? I think that's if I were to make a statement like that, it's probably factual, frankly, based on what I know and what I learned. It's a factual statement, but saying it sounds egotistical. So right. That's just not something that, like, you know, I guess I would naturally say. It has come up as a kind of counterfactual before. As a matter of fact, I think Susan Page, when in her awesome interview, kind of raised it as a counterfactual, and it brings clarity to kind of, I guess, my role. But it's not the way kind of Byron York of whatever a knucklehead paper he writes for, you know, far right paper, saying that I was a driving force. I just did what I thought was right.
Well, I was just thinking, we, for instance, we'll do this like with whistleblowers. We often do it with like victims of sexual assault. We go like, oh, this person's just after attention, or this person wants to be famous. And it's so preposterous because it's like, nobody wants to be famous for this.
No. I mean, it's funny that, like, you know, I do feel a great deal of support for America, but I also am reviled by other segments of America. Who wants to put, I mean, it's better to be like in your own little neighborhood. You've got your close circle of friends or something like that. People that you know, and nobody else knows you. At least that's in my world. I mean, I guess we live in a world now where, like, you know, people want that kind of attention, but that doesn't resonate with me. I'd rather not be reviled by like millions of people that have been, that have been lied to and convinced that, elections are stolen, and that, you know, the president is a hero. That when that last president was about as harmful a figure as in U.S. history as we've probably ever had, frankly. And I'm not saying that like kind of whimsically, you know, that we were able to, you know, even Buchanan, who kind of let us down towards civil war, was an enormous tragedy, you know. He's responsible for some 600,000 deaths in part because there are a whole other sequence of events. But this president is equally culpable in mismanaging a pandemic that magnified many times the amount of dead we have. And how is he I just don't understand how he could walk away from that. It's his mismanagement that resulted in what could have been tens of thousands of dead to 600,000 dead.
I was going to ask you about that with your study of the Soviet Union and Russia, your experiences with Trump and Giuliani. What happens to a person's soul and their personality that takes them down that road? Is it that power corrupts? Were they always like that? Is it evil? Like, how do you end up where these people have ended up?
So I think Giuliani and Trump are two different figures. I think Giuliani notoriously had a huge ego, even when he was a you know, an honorable public servant. He was justifiably kind of lauded and elevated for his service to as the mayor of New York during difficult times. He really kind of undertook some serious reforms, and then he was corrupted by power and, you know, desire for wealth. And who knows what else is, you know, he might be suffering from. I don't think Trump at any point was like that. He doesn't even understand the concept of public servants. He thinks public servants and military service members are suckers and losers. He does not understand the concept of serving anything but himself. So those are two different kind of figures. One's corrupted, and the other one may have been rotten from the very beginning.
Yeah. It's and I think this goes to the point we were talking about earlier of why you have to be strategic and why you have to be intelligent when you decide to step forward about something, because you're not playing against people who are playing by the rules.
Absolutely. I think I've got a World Press panel discussion in a couple of weeks, and we kind of I'm going to talk to a reporter that basically has covered whistleblowers for a swathes of his career. And it's interesting, you know, he asked me if I thought I was a whistleblower, and we kind of ruminated on this idea. And he said, you know, traditionally whistleblowers feel like they have no other recourse but to go to the press, because sure, they can't figure out a way to kind of navigate the system. In a lot of ways, I navigated, you know, entirely from within the system to effect. I mean, I wasn't the sole actor. We also had an intelligence community whistleblower that, you know, recognized the perils to this country and spoke up. But I didn't leak to anybody. I didn't do anything that was kind of outside of proper procedures at any point, which is, I think, is pretty amazing.
Yeah, I would agree. To me, that's a testament that you to what you did. It's not just that it was right, but you know, you talk about execution. It's also how you execute on the mission that you're embarking on.
I was very lucky. I'll go ahead and hang it on luck.
All right. That's the non-egotistical way to look at it. But yeah. But is it strange to go like? You know, clearly you have a sort of a reverence for America. It means something to you. What does it feel like to be inside the core of, you know, American government and come to the conclusion that you came to, that the president may be rotten to the core, or that this is a corruption of those fundamental values?
It was not easy. And I think, you know, there may have been kind of like a misstep of sorts. As I watched these events unfold over the preceding months before the phone call, and certainly, you know, it was clear that Giuliani was involved. I learned that it was Gordon Sondland, Mick Mulvaney, all sorts of other folks that, you know, initially it looked like you could say this was completely outside of government. Then it obviously came back to government actors being involved. But my reverence for the office of the president in certain ways didn't allow me to kind of like hang this on the office until that phone call. Because I rationalized that these might be people that are, you know, traditional kind of toady figures that look to elevate themselves, ingratiate themselves, but there was no way that the president would be behind something like this. Or at least, even if I suspected it, I wasn't, it's not something that I was going to kind of like, you know, land on firmly without something more concrete. I remember when I brought this, the hold on security assistance, out of the shadows, when it was a hold by Mick Mulvaney using his kind of levers over management and budget, and it was extra procedural. And I brought it into the national security process. I ran it through kind of what we do, these policy coordinating committees and all these things, and ran it all the way through the deputies, which is, you know, cabinet level officials, their deputies, number two guys in all the departments and agencies. And, you know, people are telling me that it's coming from the office of the president. I never, you know, I actually didn't put that in a report because I'm not going to put down the president was responsible for the hold on the security assistance. I know that, you know, it came from Mick Mulvaney, but I'm not going to attribute it to the president.
Sure.
When the president's hand became clear in that call, when he was the one that said, I need you to do us a favor, though, and proceeded to lay out, you know, this investigation. And that was I think that kind of penetrated my reverence for the office of the president. I still hold office in high regard. I just don't. I hate the idea of calling Trump, you know, President Trump. He doesn't deserve that honorific.
Well, that's something I'm struggling with, and I you've probably thought about it. What does it say about America? Not just that it could happen, not just that a lot of people were involved in it happening, and not just that only, you know, the vote to do something about it happened on very clear partisan lines, with one exception of Mitt Romney, I think a bit of an act of courage. But what does it say that a huge percentage of the American people, when asked about it, also decided that it didn't bother them? What do we do? How do we come back from that? What do we do that we've lost our ability to be outraged about these things?
Well, I think with each transgression, especially under the previous administration, the bar was set lower for government, and we stopped kind of being shocked by you know, presidential abuse. You think the president, you know, talking about groping women would have affected his ability to get elected?
Should be immediately disqualified.
Yeah. Yes. I think this should be in law. If you can't get a majority of the votes in your own constituency, like a New Yorker, then you should be excluded.
Yes.
People who know you, then you should be excluded. I think that should be a kind of like, you know, you get the majority, you get the electoral college, but also you have to earn the majority in your own constituency. So, you know, that's absolutely true that the president won 74 million plus votes, but he also lost by 7 million votes. And that's telling. That margin is unprecedented. He lost bigly in the Electoral College. I think right now there's a bit of a struggle over not the tyranny of the majority, which is what our Constitution was designed to protect, but the tyranny of the minority that has kind of been, you know, led down the primrose path and has kind of lost their way, and are holding this country hostage. And I think, you know, these are the arguments about filibuster, whether it makes sense in this current context. Whether, you know, we've crossed some sort of threshold where the majority needs to assert its rights to properly govern. I think, you know, frankly, we might be there, especially if voting rights are in jeopardy. And, you know, the tyranny of the minority is trying to hang on by, you know, disenfranchising people. But I think there's a bigger issue in play that has both an external and an internal component. External, our adversaries are always looking for seams, or always looking for avenues to kind of sow disinformation and magnify it. You know, that's a consistent pattern. But there are internal actors, political actors, that see it in their interest to also not advocate for, you know, for many one, not for unity, but for division and maintain power through division. And I think, you know, accountability, unfortunately, is going to have to come at the hands of the electorate that just cannot forget about these transgressions. And that's a starting point. I think there's also, not to belabor this point, there's also an obligation for this very, very busy administration that's focused on, you know, an enormous amount of challenges domestically and overseas, moving forward to address challenges from the previous administration, accountability, because there's a lot to be learned about the weaknesses that, you know, the president exploited.
It was a stress test.
It was a stress test. And if we don't do something, you know, if we don't take the proper steps, if we don't build in kind of a solvency. We're going to be, or next time we face a challenge from a much more competent actor, the president wasn't a competent actor, we really could be in danger.
No, I think that's right. And I think your point about laying it at the feet of the voters is right. It's going to require some ordinary acts of courage from voters to put aside the issues that you care the most about to deal with this unpleasant situation and face some truths about your own party. I'm thinking of my own father and people I'm close with. It's like, look, I get you care about all these things, but, yeah. And I get that you have very strong partisan affiliation against this or for this, and it's going to require you facing some of that to come together and deal with what is, I think, the sort of the governing crisis of our time.
Absolutely.
Sir, thank you so much. This is a complete honor. I loved the book. I thank you for your service, not your military service, of course, thank you for that, but the service that you did, that you detail in this book. As you said, it was a narrow run thing. It could have gone in another direction if you hadn't stood up and done what you did.
I appreciate it. I'm looking forward to your book. I loved you calling out. I'm going to have to start listening to this one. I love you calling out quotes and stuff like that. So that's good stuff.
My newest book, Courage is Calling, Fortune Favors the Brave, is now available for pre-order. We've got a bunch of amazing bonuses. You can get signed copies, of course. I'm so proud of this book. General Jim Mattis has called it a superb handbook for crafting a purposeful life. Matthew McConaughey, also a father, called it an urgent call to arms to each and all of us. I do hope you check it out. It's my first in the Four Virtues series, Courage, Temperance, Justice, Wisdom. Courage is Calling, Fortune Favors the Brave. If you want to pre-order it, I'd really appreciate your support. Go to dailystoic.com/pre-order. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture-themed trophies for six basketball-related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill, you might win some, but you just lost one trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.